worst drought in decades just keeps getting worse.
And where are all the profits going in China? Hello, I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. It's the Marketplace Midday Update for Wednesday, the 18th of July. Coming up, in addition to those stories, we'll also talk about some good signs in the housing market here in the U.S.
And Jeremy and I have ordered up a cake. We are approaching the two-year anniversary of Dodd-Frank. And so later on the podcast, we're going to talk with former FDIC Chair Sheila Bair, who has been busy since leaving office on the outside, trying to keep pressure on the folks on the inside to remember the goals of financial reform. That and a bunch more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
First to some news that could have a significant impact on our food prices. The dangerous heat is forecast to continue across the Midwest. That makes things pretty uncomfortable for us humans, but it's really unpleasant for corn. And this is peak time for corn pollination. Just last week, analysts were calling this year's drought the worst since the 1980s.
That's right. But now the National Climatic Data Center is calling it the worst since the 1950s. For more on what all this means for the nation's farmers and for food prices, we're joined from Litchfield, Illinois, by Mike Zuzalo. He is president of Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to be with you.
Well, great to have you. Tell us, where is the epicenter of this drought right now and how much of the country is affected?
I would say that based upon the client conversations and producer conversations, I would say probably just around Springfield, Illinois, to a little bit south, all the way over to Indianapolis or Richmond, Indiana. And it's a lot farther south than one would first think as well. So the epicenter is pretty much right in the heart of the corn belt, right in the heart of the soybean belt as well.
And analysts are cutting their corn production forecasts even more than they already had. Do you think things could get worse yet if this heat and drought continues?
I do think they could. I think one thing that we will have to keep an eye on is that if we do go drastically lower in the corn yield in particular, the futures market has, in my view, already kind of killed the crop by raising prices so drastically. And what I mean by that is that, yes, we recognize there's a lower yield, but we're also hurting the demand side, too, from the livestock producer, the feeder, to the ethanol producer. So I think that's where we want to be cognizant of what the USDA is going to be doing here in future reports as far as cutting both the yield and also the demand side, in my view.
What do you think could happen to consumers as far as prices go? Obviously, corn is not just something you buy and eat, but it also goes into the livestock that ends up being the meat that we buy at the supermarket.
Yeah, at the first quarter and second quarter of 2013, your meat prices will be sharply higher. Yeah, as far as cereal prices and what you pick off the grocery store shelves, I think you'll probably start to see either small price hikes in the next month or two. The General Mills and Kraft and those big food companies are already, many of them at least, are getting downgraded by Wall Street because of this drought. So they're probably going to try and maintain their earnings. So I would suspect they'll probably start small price increases, see how those go. We may also see the amount of weight in each box of cereal maybe drop a little bit again, similar to what we saw in the previous dry crop years of 2007-2008.
Mike Zuzalo is president of Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting. Thanks so much for your time this morning.
Nice to be with you. Thank you.
So here at Marketplace, you know, we love playing spot the Veep as much as anybody, and that is the big game this week. Palenti, Jindal, Portman, all those names are bouncing around this week, right? But after all of these parlor games, how much difference does a vice president make when it comes to shaping economic policy? Naturally, at Marketplace, that's the question we're most curious about. And from Washington, here's some historical perspective from Elizabeth Wynne Johnson.
It's the office once famously described as not worth a bucket of warm spit. In the 19th century, vice presidents had little to do with policy, economic or otherwise. That changed in the 20th century, but only to a point. Gerald Ford wooed Nelson Rockefeller by promising him a big say over domestic policy, according to Senate historian Donald Ritchie.
Rockefeller was a big government person. He was a Republican, but he was in favor of stimulating the government. He was in favor of big spending projects. And Ford was a Midwestern conservative.
And Rockefeller never did get much of a say, after all. Ford's chief of staff made sure of that. Historically, vice presidents have affected policy most through relationships with Congress, says Professor James Thurber of American University.
Many vice presidents are influential because they go to the Hill and get reactions and give feedback to the president. There's nothing like a vice president that has had experience on the Hill.
It certainly beats a bucket of warm anything. I'm Elizabeth Wynn Johnson from Marketplace.
A new report from a group called the State Budget Crisis Task Force finds, what do you know, a crisis in state budgets. It's an illustrious group that's waving the red flag here. Former OMB and CBO Director Alice Rivlin says even when the economy recovers, states will be fighting large deficits.
Many state and local services will be squeezed out by the things that really have to be funded, pensions and Medicaid. And partly because the federal government will be retrenching as it faces up to its debt situation.
And those federal cuts will likely include lots of state and local grants. Rivlin says education and prisons are most likely to feel the squeeze.
Moving overseas now, some of China's biggest companies are warning that profits for the first half of this year could be down by 50% or more. It's the latest evidence of an economic slowdown in China, and it gives you a sense of how big that slowdown might be. The BBC's John Sudworth is with us from Shanghai for more on this story. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So more signs, it looks like, pointing to an economic slowdown in China.
Yeah, more gloom and doom. It doesn't seem to end at the moment, does it? These are profit warnings from some very big companies like Air China, one of the three big government-owned airlines here, warning that their profits for the first half of this year are likely to be down something in the region of 50% or so. ZTE Corporation, one of the world's biggest producers of telecoms equipment, warning of a profit slide of up to 80%.
And do profit warnings like that from Chinese companies end up having an effect in places far from China, like right here in the United States?
Well, in some ways, it's difficult to see a main and immediate effect. But of course, there will be worries of a knock-on. The concern is this, that in some ways, China is the only last remaining engine of economic growth left in the world, with the US economy still in the doldrums, with Europe sputtering away with its sovereign debt crisis. The Chinese engine, still producing growth of around 8% a year, is the only thing that's really functioning. And, you know, some people suggest to see the global economy is a zero-sum game. China's win is our loss, or whatever, is the wrong way. And if China was to start to really see its growth fall off, we would all be the losers.
Well, how are the people there in China feeling about this slowdown?
Well, you know, it's funny. You don't see much sign of a slowdown. People are still spending. The luxury car makers, there's an Aston Martin, the famous British luxury brand car showroom down here that always seems to be doing a booming trade, and those things aren't cheap. But, you know, when you speak to people, there is a real concern in China that it can't get its domestic economy going because people are saving too much. They have very serious doubts about their own economic security. And until China squares that circle, there's real worries that the sort of economic gloom will perpetuate and become self-fulfilling.
The BBC's John Sudworth in Shanghai. Thanks a lot.
It's a pleasure.
Well, from one Asian slowdown to another, India has been hit especially hard by the debt crisis in Europe. And as Christopher Worth reports, the country is now worried about the debt it's accumulating because of all the imports it's getting from China.
Chinese goods are flooding into India. If you want an example, just look at toys.
Doggy. Bunny.
At this children's store in Mumbai, owner Kareem Rishpurohit scans a row of teddy bears and plastic robots. He takes down a toy dog. It's a hot item among kids in India right now, but
China. All product made in China. The China product is low quality.
Low quality and much less expensive than almost anything India makes. The Indian government is worried about its large and growing trade deficit with China, and it accuses it of dumping cheap goods onto the Indian market. Arvind Subramanian is with the Peterson Institute in Washington. He says the same complaints U.S. politicians make about Chinese imports can now be heard in India, too.
I'm told now what's really making Indians nervous is saris, silk saris are coming from China. You know, talk about displacing, you know, symbols of Indian culture.
And potentially displacing Indian jobs. That's the fear anyway, with India adding about 12 million new people to its workforce every year. Barry Bosworth is an expert on China and India at the Brookings Institution. He says India would like to sell more of its goods and services to China.
But India doesn't have much that China wants, to be blunt.
What China does want is raw materials. So India sends iron ore to China, and China hands back finished products, like battery-operated dolls. Michael Kugelman follows Asia at the Wilson Center. He says toys are just a tiny part of what China sends to India. It also sends essential items like ships and equipment for power plants, all things India needs to keep its economy humming along.
These are things that are pretty important in their own right for India's development and its growth, not to take away from the utility of toys.
Which is why, with India's economy slowing, he says the country should welcome the flood of Chinese goods. I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
And that story came to us with the help of the International Reporting Project in Washington, D.C.
Well, if you want to go to China, Jeff, there was a little bit of a deal yesterday. United Airlines, which usually makes its frequent flyers spend upwards of 100,000 miles on a first-class round-trip ticket to Hong Kong.
Uh-huh.
Well, yesterday there was a computer glitch, and some lucky travelers were able to get that ticket for just 4 miles and $40.
Wow, I missed it.
Now, you missed it, I missed it, but some people did get it, and United has come out and said they're not going to honor these tickets. They'll give people the chance to get the tickets at the normal price. But according to USA Today...
How generous.
Yeah, I know. According to USA Today, new Transportation Department rules might actually require the airline to honor those tickets. So, you know, next time you have a little free time and want to mess around on Facebook or Twitter, maybe you should actually head over to the airline websites and see if there are any glitches going on.
Yeah, I remember, I think, when that went into effect. And I remember thinking at the time, you know, people are going to make a career out of this. You
could, they already have.
I mean, yeah, you could have quite a little active market in scouting for cheap mile tickets and reselling them if you could do that. Anyway, we'll have to check into that.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
Jeff, happy almost anniversary.
Thank you.
2 years ago, this weekend, President Obama signed the Dodd-Frank financial reform law. Dodd-Frank, of course, followed the big bailouts of American financial firms. Many say the bailout pulled the economy back from the brink, but the ad hoc nature of it made clear we needed better ways of responding to and ideally preventing financial crises.
Sheila Bair was chair of the FDIC during the bailout and the crafting of Dodd-Frank. She later founded the Systemic Risk Council to pressure the government and the financial industry to live up to the goals of financial reform. As the anniversary approaches, we invited her to Marketplace for a check-in, and as today's Midday Extra, we have an extended version of my conversation with Sheila Bair. Sheila, hello.
I'm happy to be here.
As I recall, you were quite adamant while Dodd-Frank was being crafted that it should pave the way for essentially a bailout-free future. Do you think we got there?
Well, I think we're getting there. You know, we don't really end too big to fail until we convince the market that people who invest in these large banks and buy their debt, if they're convinced they're going to take losses if these big banks get into trouble. And there has been some progress on that score. The rating agencies have started downgrading the banks based on the reduced likelihood that they will be bailed out in the future. And their cost of funding have gone up a bit as a result of that. So I think there's more work to be done. But, yes, we are making progress.
As you continue to work and advocate to weed out various problems in the system, do you think we are stuck with anything truly problematic either in the law itself or that has come about during the implementation of Dodd-Frank?
Well, yes. I mean, I think complexity is a big issue for me. You know, Dodd-Frank is something I support. I think we're better having it than not having it. But it is a very long, complex law. And unfortunately, the regulations we're getting now are also quite lengthy and complex. The CFTC moved forward last week with its definition of swaps, which I'm glad they're moving forward. But the definition was 600 pages long, and it's basically because they have all these things in there for lobbyists saying who is not subject to these new rules. The consumer agency had a much improved mortgage disclosure form, but then it was accompanied by 1,100 pages of rules explaining how mortgages should be disclosed. So, you know, I think complexity is a real problem. It makes it difficult for public advocates, for the media, for academics to analyze the rules and understand and evaluate how effective they're going to be. It can serve as a barrier, frankly, to smaller institutions, a competitive barrier, because they just simply don't have the resources to hire the pricey lawyers that are needed to decipher these rules. So I do think complexity is a real problem, and I hope regulators going forward are more mindful with simple rules, and they just really do not need to accommodate all these lobbyist requests for special exceptions or clarifications. They just need to write the rule and tell them they can't do these things anymore.
So since the last time we talked to you on Marketplace, J.P. Morgan lost what looks like $4.5 billion of their own money. And then they had quite a profitable quarter, thank you very much. But Congress gets involved. The media reacts almost as if a law was broken or at least some kind of public trust was broken. So my question for you is, why shouldn't banks be allowed to screw up like this? Just like any other business.
Well, they should be allowed to screw up. But I think a couple of things that the J.P. Morgan Chase losses tell us. One is the serious challenges of managing banks that are this large and this complex, even for very good management. And I think Chase overall is a well-managed institution. Second of all is the propriety of using insured deposits. And these were speculative positions being taken with the deposit base at the J.P. Morgan Chase bank. You know, they were investing in what's called tranche credit default swap indices. These things are so volatile and complex, the clearinghouses won't even take them. And why in the world is government-backed money being used to do that? If Chase wants to take positions in those big, highly volatile, highly risky indices, they should not be using government-supported funds for that. That should be required to be in a walled-off affiliate where they have to go to the private markets and convince them to give them money to make those types of high-risk trading activities. So I do think that is a problem and one that needs to be correct.
And what's embedded in that is the very hazy notion still post-bailout of what is government money and what is sort of the bank's own business.
Own
it's
money.
Still, it's still really hard. It's really hard to tell now, isn't it?
Right. Well, it's, you know, the shareholders, you're right. J.P. Morgan Chase remained profitable. This loss was they had more of a completely adequate capital base to absorb this loss. But notwithstanding, the problem with using government-backed money to support this type of activity is there's really no market discipline with insured deposits. I mean, it's important to have a deposit insurance system for Main Street depositors. They need safety and peace of mind that their money is protected. But it's easy to get insured deposits. There's not a lot of market discipline. There's a lot more market discipline if they have to go to the bond markets and convince, you know, private institutional investors to support them taking ganders on CDS, tranche CDS indices. If they want to do that, they should have to convince the market that that's an activity worthwhile supporting and not use insured deposits where there's no market discipline.
So systemic risk, this term that you're so closely attached to, if I might paraphrase, is a risk to a financial institution that could have major spillover effects beyond that institution.
It's a risk to the public at large, yes.
Sure.
So a practice or an institution that if it gets into trouble, if things go wrong, can hurt innocent bystanders. That's really what I view of as systemic risk.
So going after systemic risk, it suggests safety, it suggests caution. Then we have this other important aspect of our economy where we say financial institutions are supposed to be taking risks on deserving people and businesses. We want them to lead the recovery. We want them to be more bold with what they're doing with their money in some ways. How do you reconcile what seems like a real contradiction there?
Well, I think we do want banks to take risks. We want them to lend to the real economy. We want them to take prudent risks, but we want them to take risks on economic activities that have some real economic benefit. I mean, trading tranche CDS indices with a bunch of hedge funds, I don't know what kind of positive economic benefit we get from that. Mm-hmm. Rigging interest rates, I think that's a pretty harmful practice to the real economy. So it's the kind of risk you take and whether you're taking well-measured, well-understood, well-evaluated risks. That's really the question.
There are many people out there who would have liked to have seen and might still like to see banks fail, especially big banks fail that they think have been misbehaving. What do you say to them?
Well, I say we should have let a couple of fail, and it makes me angry that we didn't. And I think there were tools there that could have been used that were not. You know, there were outliers in the 2008 crisis. It wasn't everybody. There were a couple of institutions that were clear outliers in terms of their mismanagement, the risks that they took, and they should have been put into a bankruptcy-like process, and they weren't. And I think if we had done that, that would have been more powerful than all the rules we're writing now to try to correct these misbehaviors. And I think that is an unfortunate legacy. Look, we did what we had to do. We had imperfect information and imperfect tools. I think a lot of the bailouts were more generous than they needed to be. And as I say, I think we could have been more muscular in requiring some of these banks to restructure, the ones that were failing. But, you know, be that as it may, it's a legacy of the bailouts, and it's something we have to deal with now. But, yes, allowing a couple of them to fail would have had a much more disciplining effect on market behavior than all the rules we're writing now.
Sheila Baer is the former chair of the FDIC and current chair of the Systemic Risk Council. Thanks very much.
You are welcome. Thank you.
Now, Jeremy, if, as they say, new businesses are essential to this sluggish recovery that we are trying to make not sluggish, so let's give a nod to this new business in Rochester, New York. It's called The Snuggery.
The Snuggery.
Which is just a very provocative name to begin with. And for $60 an hour, The Snuggery offers what they call non-sexual snuggling sessions, or cuddling sessions. The Snuggery's website says just a little bit of cuddling can lower your blood pressure and improve your mental and physical health. And they do have plenty of language about the fact that if you do get aroused by it, they say that's okay, but don't get any ideas.
Okay.
Sometimes I feel like I could use a little cuddle after this long early morning shift we have.
Jeff, that's for another podcast altogether. We'll have to start a new one after we're done with the midday update.
Marketplace after hours.
That's right.
You know, thinking about this just economically, if charging $60 an hour for hugging is not the pinnacle of American business creativity, I don't know what is.
You know, and there's those people out in the streets that always have free hugs. And I just try to walk as far away from them as
they're just giving it away. They can charge $60.
That's right. Well, I'm not sure snuggling alone will juice the recovery, but one thing that would definitely help us is recovery in the housing market. And there's a little bit of evidence, more evidence of that this morning. Housing starts, as they're called, that's groundbreaking on new home construction, were up 6.9% last month over the month of May and about 24% over a year ago. It's the fastest pace of growth in 3 years. And for more on this, we're joined by Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics. He is with us as he is every Wednesday. Good morning.
How's it going?
Going well. So is this more evidence of a rebound in housing?
Absolutely. You know, it's been really frustrating to watch the fits and starts over the last few years. But, you know, this particular slew of data that we've gotten over the last 3 months, 4 months, really looks like solid progress, serious traction.
And what's the effect? I mean, this is just one part of the economy, but what do you think?
Well, the good news is it's a really important part of the economy. And where it really helps us, in my view and in the view of most people that follow this type of data, is that the wealth effect from house prices not only stabilizing but eventually going up is probably the most powerful driver of consumer confidence, of people feeling as though their situation is improving. This helps spending. This helps the whole economy. The wealth effect from housing is way more important than the stock market because this is people's biggest financial asset, much more so than a 401k account. So, Jeremy, I think it's very key.
And why is it finally happening? I mean, people have been trying to make the housing market turn around for years now.
Yeah, well, the dirty secret is you can help or hurt a little bit with policy, but in the end, you really need time, especially for something where we had gotten so far away from the long-term trend. What we really needed to do was correct about 80% of the way back to trend through price, meaning house prices dropping. And then that last 20%, it looks like we're going to correct through time, meaning we'll get back to long-term trend just by sitting around here for a little while longer. And that's, you know, what deleveraging and the business cycle is all about. So the good news is we've done a lot of the hard work already.
Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics, thanks as always.
Thank you.
People in the baby boom generation probably need no reminder of the thalidomide scare that seized the world back in the 60s. The drug was prescribed by doctors in the 50s and 60s for pregnant women who were suffering from morning sickness. It wound up causing tens of thousands of birth defects around the world before being pulled from the market in 1961. Many of the victims settled claims against the drug companies back in the 70s. But today, a woman in Australia who was born without arms or legs reached a multi-million dollar settlement with the distributor of the drug. For the latest on that, Stuart Cohen joins us from Sydney. Hello, Stuart.
Hello, Jeff.
So I thought all the thalidomide settlements played out decades ago. Why has it taken so long for this one to come about?
Well, the class action lawsuit was filed by a 50-year-old woman in Melbourne named Lynette Rowe. As you mentioned, she was born without arms or legs. Her mother took thalidomide to treat morning sickness during the pregnancy, but her doctor at the time said Lynette Rowe's birth defects had nothing to do with thalidomide, instead blaming them on a virus. Now, the settlement came from the drug's distributor. The German manufacturer of the drug, Grünenthal, has declined to settle. Lynette Rowe's lawyer says they still plan to go after the manufacturer in court.
And who else could this settlement wind up affecting?
Well, there are more than 100 others who are part of the class action in Australia. They'll have their claims heard by the drug's distributor. The case is expected to pave the way for other victims around the world who've never been recognized or compensated. Here's what Rowe's lawyer Michael Gordon had to say.
Lives and families were wrecked as person after person were told that they weren't thalidomiders, that instead that this was some freak of nature, an aberration, with no explanation whatsoever. Or mothers who said that they believed they took thalidomide were not believed, and families were left to battle it out without compensation, without support for 50 years.
And finally, Stuart, is there a chance this could lead to any new legal action here in the U.S.?
Most likely, yes. Fortunately, the Food and Drug Administration never actually approved the use of thalidomide, like so many other countries around the world had. But around 20,000 patients in the United States got access to it through samples sent to doctors for clinical trials. Lawyers in the U.S., Britain, and Canada have been watching this case, and they say they plan to file similar suits.
Stuart Cohen in Sydney for us. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Jeff.
Just a couple more random items as we wrap up. There's a new study that I saw this morning, Jeremy, of parents in the UK, a survey, I guess you should say, that half of all bedtime stories there are now read on e-book readers. Do you believe that? That's just sort of stunning.
I mean, it's a growing market, you know?
Yeah, and maybe in the UK, they it's taken off even faster than it has here. Interesting to me that a lot of these are not actual e-books, but standalone apps. Of books. And I guess that just allows these books to do a lot more, you know, to have movement and all kinds of sounds. And one of the things about the apps is that they can read the books to you, which raises the kind of unsettling possibility that some decent portion of stories at bedtime might not actually be read by parents.
Just put it on auto read.
What a world we live in.
Yeah, exactly. Well, finally, to the one-time star of the New York Knicks, the inspiration for Lynn's sanity, Jeremy Lin. And Jeff, as you may have heard, the Knicks have decided to let him go to the Houston Rockets, where he'll reportedly get a 3-year contract worth about $25 million. Now, we don't know whether Jeremy Lin is disappointed by the move, but I do have a little bit of good news for him if he is. Forbes has just come out with a list of the cities where your paycheck will go the farthest. And wouldn't you know it, Houston is number one, thanks to the low cost of living. So, Jeremy Lin, if you are listening to this podcast, the good news is $25 million might just be enough to live on in Houston.
Stretch that $25 million.
As far as it can go.
You are Johnny on the spot with the list of cities items. I love it. What do you got next?
I don't know. We'll find out tomorrow on the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.